It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 29th, 2022. I've spent the last couple of weeks pondering about inflation and gas prices, transportation, and of course, how cycling fits into all of it. When we spoke with Don DiCostanzo from Pedego a few weeks ago, you might remember our mentioning someone named Ed Benjamin. He was one of the early adopters of the e-bike. Ed's been on the show in the past, but I thought his input would be a great way to bring essential understanding of the whys of the e-bike business to light. He's not only well-versed in the statistics of the e-bike business, he's become the go-to guy for fundamental training and essential information on techniques. His breadth and depth of the subject, as well as his observations about where the e-bike fits in the bigger picture, are compelling. Ed will be with me in a moment. In the second half of the show, we bring back Dr. Tab Combs. Tab is a scholar of planning and transportation at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. In contrast to what Ed Benjamin has to say about all the progress we've made for cycling, Tab reminds us that there is a long way to go in not only upgrading our infrastructure, but reimagining transportation from a planning and execution perspective. The exciting news is that it's happening. So we'll catch up with Tab in the second half of the show. First, let's head down to Florida and catch up with Ed Benjamin. Hi, Ed. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest. It's nice to have you back on the show. How are you?
No, I'm good, Diane, and I'm glad to be here. It's really a pleasure to interact with you after all these decades that we've known each other.
Well, you were on the show not that long ago. Well, maybe it was a while ago. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to go back and look. But you did make some nice comments about my conversation with Don DiCostanzo from Pedego. And so I wanted to expand a bit on the e-bike market with you because you are the e-bike guy. I can remember being in my store, and this was like decades ago, and you telling me that e-bikes were going to be the thing. And I thought, this guy's smoking something, but he wasn't. He really wasn't. So remind me and my listeners of your role in the e-bike space.
Well, the role seems awfully pretentious. I used to be a bicycle retailer. And in 1994, 95, I got out of retail. And I started a consulting company that I thought I was going to serve bicycle shops. And I learned very quickly that bicycle shop owners don't need no stinking advice.
Just ask them.
But I semi-accidentally got involved in consulting for a company that was developing an electric bicycle. And I thought that was a really good idea. And so I started looking into that as thoroughly as I could. And this was in 1996. I started traveling. In 96, electric bicycles were, even in China, a tiny business. But I started traveling and I started going to factories and component makers and battery makers and so on. And I would visit them in their factory and they would say, why are you here? What do you want to buy? And I'd say, I don't want to buy anything. And they'd say, well, what are you selling? And I'd say, I'm not here to sell anything. And they say, why are you here? And I said, I need to make friends. And that turned out to be exactly the right thing to say. So 26, 27 years later, I've spent a tremendous amount of time researching, traveling, making friends. And so the result was I'm one of the very few people that has studied the industry carefully and thoroughly for 2.5 decades. And in the process, I'm the chairman of the Light Electric Vehicle Association. I've had 160 different clients ranging from giant automobile companies to tiny garage-based inventors. I have had customers or clients that are Chinese, Taiwanese, Thai, Japanese, Korean, of course, American customers, most of the major economies in Europe. I've had somebody or several somebodies have been customers. And after a while, you learn a lot about the industry. So what has my role been? A student.
I like that. I think if we looked at ourselves as students and learning all the time, we'd get into a lot less trouble. Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Ed Benjamin. He's in Florida, which we don't even discuss the weather. He says he doesn't discuss the weather with people in Cleveland. I don't blame him. And we're talking about e-bikes, so we're going to get more into it right now. When you sent me your last email, it had a whole bunch of instructor roles at the bottom. What are all these roles you are playing? What are they?
Well, as far as e-bike world is concerned, the important one is I teach the Light Electric Vehicle Association technician training program. And right now that's an online program. It used to be in person. Hopefully it'll be in person again when it's safe for an old guy to conduct in-person classes. And our goal there is to take, usually our attendee is a bicycle mechanic, although not always, and we teach them the additional knowledge and additional skills that they need to service an electric bicycle. Now, part of that list has nothing to do with electric bicycles. I'm also a PADI scuba instructor.
Oh, that's what that is. See, I don't know anything about scuba. I don't do scuba, but I swim. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask some questions about the tech training program, because when Don and I spoke, he was setting up an in-house tech training safety thing, and they have their meetings every Tuesday and all of that. What is it that you are teaching that your typical bicycle technician or mechanic doesn't know and needs to know to service and work on electric bicycles, e-bikes?
We have several distinct areas. One of them is safety, how to keep yourself safe, how to keep your customer safe. What about electrical shock? What about fires? Of course, the most dangerous thing about an electric bicycle is the test ride, getting out in traffic. And another thing we teach is, what is electricity and how does it work? And how do you detect it and measure it? And then we also teach the skills of soldering, crimping connectors together, being able to take measurements in places that seem to be difficult to get at, and how to talk about it. We want our technicians to be able to discuss it intelligently and with the customer, and we want them to be able to report issues up the supply chain that are useful. The bike mechanic says this bike is no good. This is not a useful conversation. The bike mechanic that says the battery is at 10 volts, it must be below its low voltage cutoff point, and it's become damaged as a result, I think we're going to need to replace it. That's a better conversation.
That's interesting. So how much knowledge does the typical bicycle technician bring to your program? And is that useful? Or can you train somebody who knows nothing about bicycles?
The mechanical part of a bicycle requires more time and more knowledge and is more difficult, I think, to learn than the electrical part. The electrical part is pretty much a case of, let's figure out which component is not working and replace it. Much easier than the mechanical side of a bicycle.
So let's talk a second about replacement parts. We've had a supply chain issue in the bicycle business for going on 2 years now, and it'll probably continue for a while. What about e-bike parts?
An e-bike is mostly bicycle.
True that.
If it takes 13 months to get a bicycle saddle, it takes 13 months to get an e-bike saddle. We have been affected by the supply chain problems just like everybody else. And some of our components, such as the motor and the battery, they're unique to our particular side of the business. Supply chain issues. We use the same components, the same cells for our batteries as are used in many consumer electronics. So when we talk to the people who manufacture cells today, they frequently are saying they're on allocation. It's going to be a lengthy period of time before you'll be able to receive that order. It hasn't been catastrophic, but it means that orders that we used to see filled in 90 days or maybe even 60 days are now being filled in 6 months to more than a year. It's getting better.
I guess that's what we're all hearing. It's getting better. We just don't know when it's going to be all okay soon. So, yeah. You said to me that you wanted to tell me some statistics, and I'm really interested in them. How many e-bikes are out there, where they're coming from, and what do you think the market looks like, let's say this year, next year, and out maybe 5 years?
Okay. So the first number I'm going to give you is our estimate of how many electric bikes are in service today worldwide.
Okay.
310 million. That's 310 million electric bikes that somebody used today. Now, most of those are in Asia, where they're used as personal transportation, and mostly they're used for fairly short distances. Let's go from home to the train station, or let's go from home to a few flat city blocks to work. But there are more people riding an electric bike to work today than there are people driving an automobile to work today.
I like that.
The next number, you know, what is the market going to be? Or to this year, where the world industry is probably, and this is a very rough estimate at the moment because we don't have any data yet, but it's probably going to be something in the neighborhood of 40 million new electric bikes will enter the world market. However, we have legislation or new laws occurring in China that the experts on China, Dr. Cherry, who might be somebody you'd want to talk to, Dr. Cherry is saying we might see this bump up to more like 60 million new bikes within a year or two.
What in China is happening to make that happen? I mean, what are the new laws?
Did I warn you that I don't know everything?
Oh, absolutely not. I always thought you knew everything. Well, okay, so there are laws coming online that are going to regulate maybe automobiles. Is that what we're talking about?
I don't know for sure, but Dr. Cherry would know exactly. And it's an encouragement. One of the phrases I've always loved about Chinese, they make regulations to encourage things. Yeah, we're going to encourage you not to use that. All right. But now in the United States, in 2021, we believe, and this number is very close to correct, although there's a little bit of room for error, we believe that 880,000 bikes, electric bikes, were imported into the United States. Now, 880,000 imports means almost every bike that came to the United States, because we only have a handful of bikes that are assembled here. So almost all of our electric bikes, for that matter, almost all of our bicycles,
right,
are assembled in Asia. So 880,000 electric bikes, and they're selling through. The chatter that we hear from retailers is, I'm limited by how many bikes I can get. If I can get it, I can sell it.
What's the average price of an e-bike these days?
Depending upon the distribution channel, if it is a direct-to-the-consumer, relatively simple bike, you know, an example of this would be Rad Power or Aventon, a decent bike, but without a lot of features. $1,500 to maybe $2,000. If it is a feature-rich bike or a bike that is, I'm not really sure how to put it, if there's more to it. You know,
more maybe bells and whistles.
More bells and whistles, or maybe nicer equipment, $2,500 and up. And if it is a really nice e-mountain bike, or maybe an e-road bike, although e-mountain bikes are more popular, where everything was done to the best possible standard, more than $5,000, probably more than $7,000. But the big volume is in that $1,500 to $2,000 price point.
What's the longevity of a bike like that, do you think?
We don't know for sure, but we know that I will contrast it with bicycles.
Yeah, good.
I have a bicycle in my garden shed that my father bought in 1972. I can still get tires for it. I can still ride it. So I'd say that's a damn near immortal bicycle. And with just a little bit of care, it will last a lot longer than me. The electric bikes have batteries, and batteries do not last forever. The lithium batteries, the high quality lithium batteries that we're using on most electric bikes today, we actually don't know how long they're going to last, because if they've been made properly and taken care of, they seem to be lasting a really long time. So I'm going to say 5 years for the battery for sure, unless you've done something abusive to it. 7 years likely, some of them maybe 10 years, and then you're going to need a new battery. Now the performance of the battery will diminish over time. As batteries age, they give you less energy storage or less performance. Now, the rest of the bicycle, well, human-powered bicycles don't get ridden as far as electric bicycles do. So many years ago, I had a Raleigh Professional that I tried to keep track of how many miles it had on it. And at one point, I came to the conclusion it had 20,000 miles on it, and it was worn out. This was a Reynolds 531 frame with all Campagnolo equipment. I know I sound pretty old, don't I?
I'm right there with you.
It was worn out. I mean, it was, you could pick it up and it shook, things rattled. All right, 20,000 miles wearing out a very high quality bicycle that had been used by someone who was careful. I think the electric bike is usually not that same, the bicycle parts are not that same level of quality, but we ride it more. So how long is the bicycle part going to last? I don't know for sure, but I will suggest that 5 years is probably major maintenance time for an electric bicycle.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, I want to get some of your opinions and ideas about the United States and bicycling and how the e-bike will impact that. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm speaking with Ed Benjamin. And when you want to know about e-bikes, he's the one you want to go to find out like everything you want to know. So when we took our break, we were talking about how long an e-bike might last, and because it's going to be ridden more. And I want to know why you think it's ridden more. Although I would have to say that people are using them for different reasons, maybe.
Yes. Well, first of all, it's easier to ride.
Well, that's true.
The normal role of an electric bicycle, or perhaps the most common role of an electric bicycle, is personal transportation. We've got a lot of people that are economically challenged to the point where they're reluctant to own a car. My daughter loves to live in big, dense urban environments like San Francisco and Boston, and there's no point in owning a car.
Right.
But parking costs, insurance costs, car. But she uses a bicycle or an electric bicycle to do her normal personal travel. So that, in my mind, that is the most common use of an electric bicycle. But electric bicycles are also used by retirees who want to tool around in their neighborhood in Florida, and I suppose other places. And they're also used by people, range extenders or lifestyle extenders, to go mountain biking. One time, I'm pretty sure it was Gary Fisher that said to me that the electric mountain bike adds 15 years to your mountain biking season.
That sounds like something he would say.
Yeah. And for me to ride a mountain bike uphill nowadays is quite challenging. The electric bike is not. It makes it fun. Okay, so electric bikes get used more because they're easier. They get used more because their role is more of a workhorse than a bicycle. Americans see bicycles, by and large, we see them as sport, fitness, and recreation. Sport, fitness, and recreation are optional activities. Commuting is not an optional activity. So easier to ride, transportation role, they get ridden more miles, and we can see it. And people that sell electric bikes, of course, not every electric bike gets used more, but people that sell electric bikes will tell you they're replacing tires more often. They're replacing broken spokes as a result of use. So, the electric bike gets ridden more.
So that begs the question for me as to both laws, legal issues of riding an electric bike on the streets and paths and trails and other recreational use of the electric bikes, because there's some dispute about putting them on trails, although all the national parks originally said yes. Now, I don't know if they're starting to say no or not. And the adoption of the electric bicycle by Americans for transportation. Are you actually seeing that as a trend?
Well, the people that are really good at answering that question are People for Bikes, and I would refer you to Ash at People for Bikes. But the People for Bikes folks have done a really good job of persuading most states to adopt clear laws concerning electric bikes. And you can find that on their website, and you can find the status of your particular state on their website. I believe their website is www.pfb.com, but it would be search for People for Bikes and you'll find
it. It's peopleforbikes.org, actually.
You're right. Okay. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah. I've had Ash on the show. We haven't spoken in a while. I was just wondering what your perception was of how people think about e-bikes, but go ahead.
Well, as far as transportation is concerned, I don't think we have an issue. Because bicycles preceded cars, bicycles have always had a privileged position on the roadway. Because an electric bicycle is regarded as a bicycle by both federal and state law, it has a privileged position on the roadway. You can ride your bicycle on any roadway with a handful of posted exceptions. Bicycle path, pretty much the same situation, although there are some places where the local municipality or someone else has said, we don't want electric bikes on the bike path. Yes, there are some 28 mile an hour electric bikes, but most of them are not. In most places, the electric bike is limited to 20 miles an hour. When I ride my, even as old and fat as I am, when I ride my normal bicycle, I can go 20 miles an hour. So it's not that big a difference. Now, when we get into the off-road situation, that becomes quite contentious. There's a lot of folks who, when I say, gee, the old fat white guy can get up the mountain on his electric bicycle, and they're saying you shouldn't be there. If you can't you don't have muscular power to get up the mountain, don't come. And I understand their point. I used to be young and arrogant about my physical fitness. And I would suggest that it has become kind of a regional issue. There are some places where riding a mountain bike on double track or riding an electric mountain bike on double track is not an issue, but riding on a single track is. There are some places where the jurisdiction of the BLM versus the national park versus the national forest versus the state park versus your local municipality, you need to pay attention. You need to find out what the rules are for where you are. But I think that ultimately, in the not terribly distant future, an electric bicycle is going to be regarded as a bicycle that happens to have an electrical component to its transmission.
That would be nice if that is the way people actually thought about it, as opposed to having it be something other. Is there pushback from dealers?
Well, you know, we used to have dealers saying, well, that's just not right. that's cheating. Or I don't want to deal with that because I don't understand it. And a lot of the early electric bikes were not good bikes. A lot of them were junk. And so a lot of dealers had an unpleasant experience with electric bikes. Today, the electric bikes are pretty uniformly acceptable to very good. But one thing I've noticed about dealers, I used to be a dealer. You used to be a dealer. If something makes money for us, we become really tolerant and accepting. And the electric bicycle is making money.
Which is, you know, a lot of people are afraid of the word profit, but it seems to me that it makes a lot of sense that if you can't make money and this is what your livelihood is, chances are you're not going to put a roof over your head. I wanted to ask you about the large infrastructure bill and how that may or may not impact the bicycle and/e-bike market.
Well, any kind of a subsidy or financial support for bicycles and e-bikes is going to help. One of the things that has happened over time, and we're not talking about Build Back Better right now, but over time, bicycle industry has benefited from a huge amount of investment in bicycle paths. And it has done wonders for the industry. Now, the Build Back Better is I've got to confess that I don't pay daily minute attention to that bill because I see it as a political football. And right now it seems as though our political process makes anything good extremely hard. Would this be good? Yes, it's pretty obvious it would be good, but I'm not aware of it being on the verge of passing.
Right. And I don't know what the Bike Summit's going to if it does anything this year. I mean, this year, nobody wants to go up on Capitol Hill and talk about anything but a war. So I'm not sure what's going on. Well, do you have any final thoughts about just the market in general and how the economy is affected or not affected or affecting and not affecting e-bikes?
Well, I will observe, a moment ago, we talked about making money.
Right.
The bicycle industry as a whole worldwide has done a magnificent job of reducing the price of a bicycle down to the point where nobody in the industry made much money. Then along comes the electric bicycle. Electric bicycle is a bigger ticket. It has more expensive service needs over its lifetime, and it's not a commodity. Everybody that's in the electric bicycle industry, this is where they're making money. The bicycle industry of the world is making its money currently in the electric bike business. If we look in Europe, for example, the Excel Group, the Pong Group, the profitable part of their business is the electric bike business. If you look at comments that John Burke made, I think about maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago, he said, this is our future. This is where we're going to make, where we are making our money.
So that brings up one more point, which I didn't really expect to talk about, but when you put it in those terms, in many cases, when you walk into a traditional bicycle shop and look at the price of a bicycle and see price tags in the $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 range, you are discouraging the sport and an awful lot of people from riding. If e-bikes are good at $1,500, which a road bike is not usually very good at $1,500, isn't that another reason to perhaps get into riding an e-bike?
Well, it depends upon what you want to do, but
true,
you and I are both old time bicycle aficionados, and we would both agree that a $5,000 or $6,000 road bike has got its virtues. But the vast majority of Americans would say, what?
Right.
And
I can buy a used car for that, which is what
they wouldn't pay any attention at all to the idea of buying that bike. And there is a very tiny group of people in America that see a value in it. And by the way, that tiny group of people, for the most part, is aging out. The high-end bicycle market has been diminishing. All right. So the person who walks into the bicycle shop and sees an expensive bicycle and says, that has a value for me, is a tiny minority at this time. The person who says, I need a way to get to work. You know, I used to tell people, you want to have some idea what is going on in the electric bike business in your town, do a backdoor survey, drive past the back door of the local bar, the back door of the local hospital where people park, the workers park, the back door of the local hotel where the cleaning staff parks, and count the number of electric bicycles in the rack. In my town, Fort Myers, Florida, where the weather is agreeable most of the time, there's been a steady increase in the number of electric bikes that I see in those parking spots and on the road. These are not cyclists. These are people who will never go in a bicycle shop. And let me emphasize that. It would never occur to them to go to a bike shop. I once interviewed some of these folks, and I asked the guy one time, he's wearing cowboy boots and he's riding a bicycle he bought at Walmart. And I said, how did you decide on this bike? He said, well, I needed a good bike. So I went to Walmart, which is where I buy almost everything. And I bought the most expensive bike that they offered. I thought that would be a good bike. Okay, that's the bulk of America, folks. That's not the bicycle shop customer.
Who's fixing that bike?
Well, it wasn't in good shape. I don't think anybody was fixing it. So, but my point would be the bicycle industry has been looking at this through its own prejudices and its own biases, and they don't apply. Some of the bicycle dealers have adapted to that. Many of them have. Bicycle dealers are not stupid people. But an awful lot of them are still looking at it with the prejudices that they developed in the normal bicycle business. And it reminds me a little bit of speaking to any normal bicycle shop guy out there. You probably don't remember when fat tires and upright handlebars were an absurd idea. Nobody wants to buy that until the mountain bike test riding customer came into the parking lot with a giant grin on their face. And you woke up to the fact that, oh, yeah, this might sell.
I absolutely remember it.
Same thing with electric bikes. The electric bike customer comes back into the parking lot with a giant grin on their face.
What a great place to end our conversation. Well, Ed, thank you so much for talking with me today. What a great conversation. We haven't spoken in a long time, but I got a lot out of this today, and it has made me even more likely to go test ride one. I've been putting it off and putting it off. We've talked about putting an e-assist on our tandem, but we haven't figured that out yet. So,
I mentioned Estelle Gray and Sally Edwards. They own, I'm not sure how many electric bikes now, but you want to talk about the last people in America that are going to adopt an electric bike? Those two.
Right. Well, and then there's the whole category of e-cargo bikes, which is another whole category. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. We'll talk again.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Ed Benjamin joined me from his home in Florida, where it's warm and sunny. Damn it. Anyway, I appreciate his perspective, and I learned a lot from what he had to say today. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk transportation and planning with Dr. Tab Combs. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. 40,000 people will die on the roads this year. Many, if not most of them, vulnerable road users. It's a number that should make us angry enough to demand change, but we know that just laments and demands don't usually work. When the pandemic hit, we had this euphoric sense of owning the roads. We were almost lulled into the possibility of being safe on the roads that aren't congested with automobile traffic, and almost were able to forget the vitriol it brings with all the upset drivers. But now we are in crisis mode with the pandemic still looming, higher inflation, and rising gas prices. We're even looking at short-term solutions for long-term problems, things such as tax holidays and cash payments to car owners. What needs to change, and how can we use the available resources to influence that change? Where is the money to make these changes, or do we have our priorities out of whack? In her work at UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. Tab Combs thinks about all of these things and a whole lot more.
Hi, Tab. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Good to see you. Looking forward to catching up. How are you?
I'm doing well, and it's great to see you, Diane.
Yeah, we actually get to see each other, even though it's not really see each other. You know, it's virtual stuff. So the last time we spoke was 2020, and a lot of things have happened since then. A pandemic, of course, which opened and closed a lot of streets. We talked about that last time, how there was kind of a good part of streets actually being open to cycling. But now it seems like everything's getting back to normal and people are horrible in cars. I want to know what you've been doing, what has changed for you, and how you see transportation today as the planner and scholar that you are.
So, you know, we have noticed that the driving has changed. There are more people driving and there are more people driving fast. Overall speeds have gone up. Vehicle miles traveled have gone up since before the pandemic. But personally, we've sort of had a response to this change by moving houses. We used to live right next to a highway that was really noisy, and we've been trying to move away from it before the pandemic, but just, you know, the market was really hot and we couldn't afford anything. Then we had this 2-week, you know, shutdown, COVID shutdowns, when traffic pretty much went away and it was lovely. And then it came back. There was more traffic. It was louder and we just couldn't not hear it anymore. And it started to take a toll on our family, on our mental health, on our enjoyment of life. And so we were like, we have to find a way to live somewhere quieter, to get away from this highway. And we did. We found a fixer-upper. I don't think everyone would term it a fixer-upper. Some might term it a tear-down, but we're fixer-upping it. And it's, you know, it's a maybe a quarter mile farther away from the highway. And the difference has just been, it's been so worth it for us.
Wow.
I mean, that's been a big change for us.
So I also noticed, and I know you use your bicycle for transportation back and forth to UNC, and you've put cameras, the Cycle IQ, or some people call them cyclic, but it's Cycle IQ cameras, front and back on your bike. Mm-hmm. How has that made a difference for you?
You know, it's funny. I've been thinking about doing it for a while, and I had these, I had high hopes for, you know, having cameras, the ability to demonstrate the challenges that are facing people who are trying to get around by bicycle in just, you know, an average U.S. town, but specifically, you know, where I live in Chapel Hill. But what I've noticed that it, at least from my camera footage, my riding seems pretty tame. I'm not seeing the dramatic, like the drama of the challenges that I face. It's not visually dramatic. It's more that they're just a bunch of subtle jabs at safety and mobility. Like when a bike path is closed, as happened here recently, and you've got to ride on the shoulder of a highway. You know, you stop and wait until there's, you know, very little traffic to do it. And so the footage you're getting is sort of an empty highway that you're riding alongside. And it's like, well, that's not, that footage is not all that telling. Or, you know, if motorists are permitted to cross over a ped bike crossing when we have the walk signal, which happens commonly at intersections here. I know that's going to happen. And so I just don't put myself in harm's way. And so I don't get footage that's really dramatic that shows that. And so there are problems that we know exist that, that we sort of naturally avoid on a bike. And so we don't get that footage that I was like, I was convinced I was going to get all of this dramatic video footage, and I'm not. And, you know, the situation is a lot worse for people like kids or novice cyclists that don't understand where these hazards are and don't know how to put themselves out of harm's way. But it's not like I'm going to go strap a camera on my kid's bike and say, hey, go act like a kid on these roads. And so I'm not getting, you know, that footage. And there are also these big structural problems, like just an overall lack of safe and connected bike facilities across town. But again, those aren't things you can pick up on a bike camera. You know, I pick my routes really carefully. I avoid the places that are really sketchy. If there's somewhere I need to go that I know I can't go safely on a bike, I'll take my car or I'll ask my partner to pick something up for me because he doesn't bike around. He drives. And so, you know, I'm not catching much of the drama. So while I'm glad for my camera and I'm really appreciating that, you know, what I'm able to document, it's not showing me anything truly dramatic. And I hope it stays that way. I mean, I hope that it, in the end, it's like, well, this is a waste of money, but it's been fun.
Right, right. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dr. Tab Combs. She is a transportation planning and policy scholar. She's at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we have spoken with her in the past. If you want to hear our original conversation, it's back in 2020 on OutspokenCyclist.com. I was going to ask about using the information you find to pursue somebody in particular, but if you're finding that you're not having to document it, and part of it is your way of riding, you know, that you don't put yourself in a position to come across people being really stupid, or you anticipate that stupidity and anger and upset.
I have noticed every now and then I've captured a little bit of just bad driving on my footage. But what I really want to show is that even when people are driving, you know, normally driving lawfully, without appropriate infrastructure, that still puts cyclists in harm's way. And so, like, while I've captured some things that are troublesome, I'm not really going to pursue that because the bigger picture is our infrastructure is failing us. Yes, there are also some motorists who are failing us, but like going after that is not tackling the bigger systemic problem of just not, you know, not keeping bicyclists out of harm's way, of just everyday driving.
So, and that brings me to the next topic, which is the most important. The last time we spoke, we did discuss the way urban planners used to think about roads and highways and bridges and all of that. And things are changing, at least we hope so. And modern urban planners, younger and more savvy, I guess, if you want to use that word, urban planners seem to be looking at infrastructure and planning differently. So they're not looking at all concrete all the time. So I'm wondering, what's going on, let's say in Chapel Hill, for example, that is beginning to look like a more ped bike friendly infrastructure, and how is government and legislation and planning sort of working together to maybe make it better?
You know, I think we're not, what we're seeing on the ground doesn't really reflect the optimism that I still have about lessons that we can learn from the pandemic. We have much larger audiences of people who are recognizing the value of reimagining public space, particularly road space, for other uses than just driving and storing cars. And I do think that that's going to ultimately have some long-lasting impacts on planning and engineering. But, you know, we're still in crisis mode. The pandemic crisis seems to have waned, but the conversation about the current spike in gas prices, I think, is exhibit A of the fact that we're not making long-term decisions. We're still making short-term decisions. We're seeing governments talk about gas tax holidays and actual cash payments to people who own cars. That's a crisis response. That's not forward thinking. It's not just a Band-Aid. It's a dirty Band-Aid. It makes the situation worse in the long run. And I also think we're seeing people under a lot of stress overall because of the sustained pandemic. It's nowhere near over. People are still very much in survival mode. And it's hard to, even if we have these ideas and these dreams, and these dreams are, making it into the planning profession and making it into these public conversations, we still don't have the wherewithal to implement things because of this, the fact that we're all struggling. Everybody's dealing with unprecedented levels of anxiety and stress and just concern about our own futures, much less the ability to plan for public futures. And so I think that's sort of inhibited change here, even though we're still thinking about it. I'm still optimistic that we'll get there. Other cities have had a little bit more luck than we have here. And that's something that I want to study is why are some cities able to be moving past pandemic planning and into the next phase of transportation planning? We haven't managed to do that here, from what I can tell. And another problem is, we have decades upon decades worth of manuals, like training manuals, engineering guides, and legal precedent that tell us to do things one way, like this very car-centric way. And all of those guides, all that training provides comfort and cover for the transportation professions. And asking people who have trained in one particular way and have spent their entire professional careers planning and building things one way to change and do things completely differently is a really big ask. And it's one that needs to happen for sure. 40,000 human lives a year are at stake in this country, but getting people to stop doing what their profession has always told them is right is gonna require very careful and empathetic messaging. And it's hard to do that when we're in crisis mode.
So I have a question about, the idea of trickle down, help, assistance. And that is that you have people like Blumenthal at the congressional level, you have Pete Buttigieg, you have an administration that is looking, I know that they're looking at roads and bridges. Nothing could have been worse than having the president go to Pittsburgh and have a bridge collapse right behind him, mm-hmm. To show how bad the infrastructure really is. But there is money for paths and bicycle pedestrian infrastructure. Is any of that quote unquote trickling down so that urban planners can actually implement some of their ideas?
There's always been money. We have trillions of dollars in our budget that we spend, billions of it on bridges and roads and other infrastructure for cars. There has always been money for pedestrian and bicycle projects that we hear this commonly from local and state leaders. There's not money. We don't have money in the budget for this project. And it's this manufactured scarcity that there's money. We don't have the priorities for this infrastructure, but we have the money. And we're seeing a shift in the willingness to reprioritize a little bit at the state and federal levels. I am fascinated by the BIL, the Bilateral Infrastructure Law, to see how those shifts in priorities actually do translate to shifts in funding and shifts in mandates. But the BIL is huge. We're still trying to wrap our heads around what's in it, what it means. There are areas of transportation that haven't been giving attention or funding before that are now suddenly in the spotlight. There's work that's not historically been formally considered transportation stuff that's now finding itself welcome in the transportation tent. And then a lot of the work that we've always been doing that we haven't felt like has gained a lot of traction is suddenly gaining traction. It's overwhelming. It's exciting, but it's taking a long time for us to figure out what it all means in terms of getting good, connected, safe pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure on the ground where it needs to be.
Let's take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk about a workshop that you're about to launch. I think it's April 22nd. We're speaking with Dr. Tab Combs in the University of North Carolina, although I think you're home today and not at the university. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Dr. Tab Combs. We've spoken in the past. She's a scholar of transportation planning and policy at the University of North Carolina. And I wanted to bring in Tom Flood for a moment. I saw a post of yours on Twitter and I just loved what I saw. So I contacted him and I did have him on the show. He was really interesting and engaging. And he uses messaging, some of it very bold, to get his ideas about transportation. He's not a transportation guy. He's a marketing guy, which is kind of interesting. But he has this kid that he commutes to school back and forth, takes the kid back and forth. And you've invited him to be with you on this workshop. Tell us about this workshop that's coming up, Flipping the Script on Traffic Violence.
Yeah, so I'm really, really excited about this workshop. This was something that is sort of growing out of a lecture series that we run at UNC that's sponsored by one of our federal research, transportation research centers, the Collaborative Sciences Center for Road Safety. We do this lecture series every fall where we try and bring in people with a lot of different perspectives on the culture of safety, on how people use roads, how we think about and perceive roads from a bunch of different perspectives. And we brought Tom in as our keynote lecturer last fall, and he was fabulous. One of the things that came through really powerfully in his talk is the need to develop skills in our future planners and future decision makers, skills for empathetic but powerful messaging of the urgency of the road safety crisis. Tom is a global leader in this space because of his marketing background, his gifts with communication, and just his own lived experience trying to keep his kids alive, taking them to and from school. And so we started talking after that, and we're like, come teach us how to do this. How do we build these skills to create these messages so that we can reach diverse audiences in a way that resonates with them? The activist community, the advocacy community does a lot of hard work, but we don't always reach skeptics. And we need to. We desperately need to. And so we're bringing Tom in. He's really the main event for this workshop. We're going to do a bike ride through our community with a couple of local bike advocacy leaders. And we're going to get a lot of footage from that, and we're going to stop at points of interest and talk through them. And then we're going to do the same with a walking speed tour of the downtown. Then Tom's going to facilitate a discussion and debrief where we can talk about what we experienced, what we saw, what we think the challenges are, and he's going to walk us through coming to a shared understanding of what we've experienced. And then the next day, we're going to bring a smaller group back that's mostly going to be students, but also a couple of community leaders to try and develop and create some messaging materials and create some talking points I'm hopeful that we can maybe get a couple of TikTok videos out of it and also have, you know, maybe a dozen students come out with confidence and the ability to reach out to decision makers, reach out to members of the public that haven't been part of, you know, haven't been considered allies in the past for pedestrian and bike safety, and have conversations that do resonate better. I mean, that's the overall goal, is to equip our future professionals with these abilities to create more diverse coalitions and have messages that resonate with a much more diverse audience.
I think that the idea of using social media to get a message out seems to be the right way to go about it these days. You know, if billboards, which is the way I used to think about things, this is like an electronic billboard, you know, something that comes up time and again and then gets shared in a whole different way than somebody just driving past the billboard coming from the airport, for example. So I think it's a really cool idea. So who is going to, besides the students and you and Tom, is this going to be basically just a local or regional, or are you reaching out to people in other areas to come to this workshop? And when is it exactly?
So it's April 22nd and 23rd, and it's in Chapel Hill. So we're looking for a local, mostly local audience of some of our students. We have some elected leaders from Chapel Hill in our neighboring town, Carrboro. We've invited members of the media who I hope will come. I'm not sure if you know Arlie Greenwald.
I do.
Bike Shop Girl. She is going to come and provide some film support, videography support for us. And so it really is sort of a community-based effort here in Chapel Hill. But what I'm hoping is that it can serve as a model for Tom to do similar workshops elsewhere. I mean, I don't know if you've seen, but the response to our post about the workshop on social media have come from all over the place. People saying, can I do it? Will it be virtual? Will you do this again? Can we get you to my town to do this? And so if this is something that becomes, you know, a bigger event and can be replicated in more places, then I would be absolutely tickled to see that happen.
It seems to me that developing some sort of a platform that includes a, you know, A, B, C, D, and then coming out with the message for a local area, you know, obviously it's different in Chapel Hill than it'd be in Northeast Ohio or in Pittsburgh or Indianapolis. But it seems to me that you could come up with a template that might really start moving the needle on it. I would love to see that. So what's the future here? What are you thinking that the long-term goal needs to be? We have a huge amount of money coming into the transportation space, coming from the infrastructure bill that was passed, bipartisan, allegedly. You know, how much of that is going to impact what you're doing and what is the future going to look like?
So we have seen a bunch of requests for proposals come through. Most of the people I work with, we're under layers of proposals right now. And I mean, it's great. It's exhausting for sure. But it's great to see the funding that's available for transportation research. And it's not business as usual. We're being pushed to bring in a lot of other different concepts that have always been very important to transportation, but haven't made it into these federal funding models. And so, you know, we're looking at social justice and mobility justice now by default. To the extent that we know how, we are centering these issues and layering the more traditional transportation research things underneath these overarching challenges. We're being pushed to focus a lot more on access to opportunity, on travel conditions for children, for the elderly, for tourists, for groups that typically haven't been centered. I mean, that's wonderful for us. That's stuff that we have always wanted to do, but have always had to keep on the margins because that's not what our funders have been asking for. And so being able to integrate that into our main bodies of work is something that we are really excited about. You know, a big chunk of what I'm doing these days is continuing to document how the transportation field and how the planning field adapted during the pandemic and implementing, which we can now do with this change in funding culture, implementing the research agenda that my colleague and former guest on your show, Carlos Pardo, and I laid out based on what we saw early on during the pandemic. This is work that I wanted to do, and now I'm seeing funding opportunities to enable it.
Well, when you mentioned Carlos, that sounds like maybe it's not just national, it's worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the pandemic, worldwide. And so Carlos and I got together early on in the pandemic virtually, obviously, since we couldn't go anywhere, and put our heads together thinking about this global phenomenon of rethinking road space. And he was really instrumental in developing the data that we've collected and bringing in these more global perspectives.
The last thing I want to know, and I think my listeners want to know, is how to follow the work that you're doing and whether or not they can get some sort of information either after or during the workshop.
So for the workshop, we're definitely going to put out, we're gonna document it as much as we can with photo and video. We're going to put out a summary. If the students do create anything that we can share on social media in the more hands-on part of the workshop, that's certainly going to be stuff that we package up and we put out there. We're doing all of this because we want to share it. We want these messages to get out. So we'll definitely, however we can provide information about what we did and what we learned publicly, we will definitely do that. And I will be tweeting about that ad nauseum. My Twitter handle is at Dr. T. Combs. I try and use Twitter mostly personally. I have a work website, tarheels.live/TScombs is where I try and keep my work stuff. But, you know, I live my work. My work is transportation planning and road safety, and I can't get away from that when you go home. So they do spill over onto each other from time to time. So if you really want to keep up with what I'm doing, Twitter is truly the best way to do it.
Well, I really appreciate that you made time for me this morning. You know that I'm fascinated by and interested in urban planning and seeing transportation move away from such a car-centric way of living. And I think that, you know, with all the bad things that are happening, changes in transportation that are positive for cyclists and pedestrians are one of the good things. And so I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you. I love your show, and I am delighted to be able to be back on it.
Thanks. You have a wonderful day. I'll be watching for some really cool TikTok videos out of your workshop, and we will post that information on OutspokenCyclist.com. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk again. My thanks to Dr. Tab Combs for joining me today. I think her work is fascinating. If you're interested in the workshop on April 22nd, you can check out a link on our website, OutspokenCyclist.com. And you can follow Tab on Twitter at DRTCombs. My thanks once again to Ed Benjamin for joining me to talk about e-bikes. And of course, my thanks to you for listening in. I've got some great guests lined up for new episodes of The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can always find photos, links, and show notes for every episode on OutspokenCyclist.com. I can also finally give you a quick update on my friend Dmitry Nechayev. His family arrived safely in Israel this past week, and they are getting ready to start a new life there. With that positive news, I hope you are safe and well. Please keep the people of Ukraine in your thoughts and intentions. Have a great week, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.